This presentation on apologetics and worldview by Dr. Paul Hennebury of TELUS Theological Ministries is offered for the edification of all students of God's Word by spiritandtruth.org. It is our prayer that this presentation will deepen your understanding of the Bible, resulting in an improved ability to share your faith with others. Now let's begin our time with Dr. Hennebury.
We were talking about the rules of the game. Do you remember that? I remember the interchange with Daniel Dennett, and he's one of these guys that believes, you know, that consciousness can be explained by the laws of physics. And you think the way you think, and he thinks the way he thinks, purely because of the forces of physics on the material elements of the universe. The materialism is all there is. You know, the natural world is all there is. No supernatural realm, no spiritual realm. That's all that there is. And remember that he wanted to debate the Christian by using his net. Remember? And he wanted to envisage a debate or an argument between an atheist and a Christian as a game of tennis. Obviously, it can be verbal tennis, it would be ideas, but he said, hold on a minute, though, before we start, okay, tennis has rules. Tennis has a net. I'm going to draw a net here. Probably be as bad as the one I did last week, but... So you have a net, okay, and then you have the, you know, the court, and your two tennis players, and but this net is naturalism, and naturalism is the only thing that is reasonable. Now, here he is, Daniel Dennett, he's up here. He's a naturalist. Here's the Christian. And what is he? Is he a naturalist? He's a supernaturalist, isn't he? Yes. So is this going to be a fair game of tennis? Because he said, look, if you're going to use reason, we're going to have to argue within the bounds of naturalism. He's rigging the game. Yeah. Isn't he? He's rigging the game right at the offset. If you debate him on his terms, you've already lost because you've already given the farm away. Do you see? He's got no right to rig the game like that. What you do is that you have to question the net and say, well, hold on, I'm not playing with that net. That's cheating. You've already circumscribed what can and can't be rational. So you don't do that. You do not allow the unbeliever to set the rules of the game. He wants, because he believes he's unbiased, okay, he believes he's neutral. I mean, if you talk to an unbeliever, particularly a secularist, they absolutely believe they're neutral observers. Absolutely. It's an unquestioned presupposition of theirs. If you allow them to start that way without saying, you're not neutral, you're biased. I'm biased too, by the way. Mm-hmm. But don't think that I'm the biased one and you're just this neutral observer. I'm not buying that for a second. And you'll have to expose his bias. This is exposed by, remember what we talked about last week, the antithesis. You have to look at the antithesis. Thesis, there we go. Antithesis is basically the opposing views. And a Christian must always understand that there is an antithesis between the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, and the unbelieving worldview. Always. Because there's this antithetical relationship between the two, okay, you cannot cross over into his point of view unless you're going to critique it from within. Okay? But you must not cross over there and pretend he's on neutral ground. He's not. And neither are you. You're for the Bible. You're for Christ. You're in the light. You've been saved out of what he's in. You don't go back into it again. That doesn't glorify God. I mean, talk about irrationality. God saved you into the light, but you have to go back into the darkness in order to argue yourself into the light. Because God hasn't given you the ability to argue actually it when you're in the light. Isn't that dumb, thinking about that? No, you must stand on biblical ground. Why? Because the biblical worldview is the picture of reality. It is the picture of reality. The other worldviews, the other pictures of reality, don't work. They don't describe reality. They're facades. To use Jesus' metaphor in the Sermon on the Mount, they're all built on sand. Do you remember what he says there? The end of Matthew 7? The one who hears my words and does them will be likened to a man who built his house on a rock. The one who hears my words and does not do them builds his hand on the sand. What's the difference between the two things? What's Jesus talking about? What's the crucial difference in the illustration that Jesus is pointing to? Yeah, I mean, yes. Of what, though? His words, exactly. You see, Jesus is not giving you a fence to straddle. He's saying you build on his words. Well, his words, he's the Son of God. He claims to be the only way of salvation. He claims to be the creator of the world. He claims to be the one who has the authority to say what's right and what's wrong. Do you see? So you're either building on his words, in which case you cannot put his words aside to argue with an unbeliever, or you're not building on his words. You're a believer in some of his words, but you're actually building your life on sand. Do you see? It's why many Christians are nowadays. Okay, and the storms come and so on, and the house gets knocked down. Why? Because you're built on a non-Christian worldview. That's why. There are so many. I don't say this to be negative or anything like that, but you've got to be careful with worldview studies. Okay, Christian worldview studies that are out there for teens, most of them are not Christian. Okay, most of them are just Bible verses stuck onto basically a non-biblical worldview. And the reason they're non-biblical is because they don't really connect the Christian young person with what the Bible's saying about reality. Okay, it's so important that we do that. They understand this is the only place to talk about reality from. Another way of saying this that Van Til used to use, you know, with the net, he was talking in terms of a fishing net. And he said, well, the unbeliever likes to argue like a fisherman who says, what my net can't catch ain't fish. In other words, I'm only going to argue about stuff that can go in my net. Okay? And I'm the one who says what can go in my net. So if you want to argue about God, God doesn't come in my net, do you see? So we can't argue about that. But when we argue about it, I'm just going to dismiss it because my net don't catch that kind of fish. Do you see? You got to be careful of the way unbelievers operate. They are not, as I've said, they are not neutral observers. All right. I wanted to do an experiment. Oh, actually, I can do the experiment. It's going to be weird, but I hope you'll, can you bear with me? I wanted to get a walking stick, and I was a little bit late, but I suppose we can use one of those contraptions over there. Can you get that green one for me? And we need to turn it upside down, I think. And I don't know if Hannah is willing to do this experiment. Are you willing to be a guinea pig for me? Okay. All right. Well, come over here a little bit. Okay. So this is not going to work particularly well, actually, because you really need a walking stick for this. Okay? But anyway, I want you to be blind. I want you to be a blind person. All right? And all I want you to do is kind of to walk up there, tapping with this, okay, as a kind of a walking stick. You've seen these blind people tap in front of them? Okay, so just do that. Do nice and slowly, and we'll tell you if you're going to run into anything. Okay. All right, come back again. Okay, now, well, go slower. All right. Now that's really easy because she knew which way to go, okay? What happens if I asked her to navigate, put some chairs in the way there, okay? And I asked you to navigate between the chairs. Then you would have to go with a little bit more care, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. What would you be doing? What would you have to do with this? You'd really have to feel around, yeah. So let's put a couple of chairs here in front. All right. There we are. Okay. And if someone will stand up just in case she starts walking into a chair. Okay. I want you to do the same thing. Okay. All right. Now you're going to, this is the thing that's going to, you're going to navigate with. Okay. Not your eyes.
Okay.
Okay. So you ready? Okay. Okay, all right. Good. Okay, come back. Come back, come back. All right. Okay, all right. Yeah, you're sapping? Okay, yeah, all right. Okay, thank you. Now, you can sit down now. Thank you very much. Now, this is not a very good walking stick, obviously. But one of the things that she was doing, okay, is that she was accumulating knowledge. Wasn't she?
Yeah.
How was she accumulating the knowledge?
Well, she looked at the chairs.
Yes. Let's kind of forget about that. That's true.
She was testing.
She was testing. She was probing, wasn't she? Okay.
The bad echolocation type thing. Sending messages of getting.
Okay. So.
Her world, her reality was created by her probing with that.
All right. So she's probing. She's probing with the end of the stick. Okay. Okay. But what else is she doing while she's probing?
She's moving.
She's moving, isn't she? Okay. So she's probing. Where do you think, and she's moving, where do you think her attention is? Her attention is at the end of the stick, isn't it? Her attention is not with her moving. Well, how can she move then?
Because her probing is what guides her movement.
Yeah, but how can she, if she, all of her attention is on her probing, okay, how can she move without having attention on her movement? Okay, what else is happening though? Again, think of this as a walking stick. Okay, she has to hold it, doesn't she?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she probes down here, but in order to probe down here, she has to do something up here, doesn't she? She has to feel through the probe through here, okay? And she has to also direct this as well as feeling. So while she's directing, she's feeling the probe, but then she's getting information from the probe as well as she moves forward. All of that is knowledge. But some of that knowledge is not the focus of what she's trying to know. Do you see? The focus is in the end of the probe. Yes? But there's other knowledge that's happening at the same time, which she's almost taking for granted. Do you see that? That's called subsidiary knowledge. Okay? Because we have to have a nice word for it. Let's kind of... Are you guys okay with that illustration? You understand what's going on there? All right. Let's write that down then. So, subsidiary knowledge. Another way of talking about this, if you want another word, is tacit knowledge. Okay? Now, the subsidiary knowledge is not what she's focusing on. It's what's enabling her to do the experiment or do what she's doing, the activity, while she's focusing on a particular thing. You think about riding a bike. Okay, when you're first riding a bike, you're concentrating on not falling off. You're concentrating on keeping your balance, okay? But after a while, are you focusing on keeping your balance anymore?
No,
that's an interesting thing. Let's remember about it. Let's remember that. Now, the probing side of it is focal. You call it focal. Because you're, you know, focusing on it. Now, I hope you can see with that little example that there is a kind of transference from one to the other. Do you see? It's like a from-to knowledge. Okay? You have to assume, you know, when you're probing, you have to assume that you're moving your movement, even though you're not focusing on your movement so much. You're focusing on the probe. And you also are you're not focusing on your end of the stick, but you're focusing on the probe end of the stick. Do you see? But you need to have that subsidiary knowledge that is receiving information as well as conveying information in order for the probe to work. The more you do that, and you see these blind people, and they, you know, they can cross roads, and they seem comfortable at doing that, because even this work with the probe becomes somewhat subsidiary to them. Not totally, of course, but they come to be able to move around a house. You know, Russ Reinert, for example. You know, he tends to be able to move around his house pretty well because he has felt his way around. He knows his way around, okay? So, all knowledge is like that. But that is not the way that we think about knowledge. Do you see? This focal knowledge, the probing, is a skill. Okay? But so is this. And we need these backup skills, as it were, in order to do this skill. And in fact, this set of skills, this tacit knowledge that we're not thinking about, we just do it. Okay? That skill is necessary to learn this. So do you see how much we have to take for granted in order to find out new things? Okay? You understand that? I want to give you a couple of illustrations here from the work of a guy called Michael Polanyi. Polanyi was a world-class chemist in the first part of the 20th century, very close to a Nobel Prize, knew Einstein and these other people. His son actually did win a Nobel Prize. And Polanyi, when he was in his 50s, he stopped working as a chemist and became a philosopher of science. And he's not well known, he's certainly not as well known as he should be. But Polanyi's work, because he was a scientist, he understood what a scientist does, and he tried to talk about how knowledge really is. Okay? So we'll be looking at Polanyi's work. I just want to give you, let's see, I'll give you one example here. Not all his work is easy to read. This is a short book called A Tacit Dimension, but it's not an easy read. But I'll give you an illustration of what he says. Maybe you can latch onto this. He says, "I shall consider human knowledge by starting from the fact that we know more than we can tell." If he's famous for anything, he's famous for that saying. We know more than we can tell. Which, of course, this would be true. And by the way, I think we all know that, don't we? Okay? The stuff that we know, but we can't explain it. We don't even explain how we know it, but we just know it. "This fact seems obvious enough, but it is not easy to say exactly what it means. Take an example. We know a person's face and can recognize it among 1,000, indeed among 1,000,000. Yet we usually cannot tell how we recognize a face we know. So most of this knowledge cannot be put into words. But the police have recently introduced a method by which we can communicate much of this knowledge. They have made a large collection of pictures showing a variety of noses, mouths, and other features. From these, the witness selects the particulars of the face he knows, and the pieces can then be put together to form a reasonably good likeness of the face. This may suggest that we can communicate, after all, our knowledge of the physiognomy, provided we are given adequate means for expressing ourselves. But the application of the police method does not change the fact that previous to it, we did know more than we could tell at the time." You see? So what he's doing there is he's just trying to bring to our attention this really crucial aspect of knowledge and of knowing things that the modern kind of scientific way of thinking of doing things has kind of forgotten about. Particularly the kind of science that says stupid things like consciousness is just the firing of neurons in your brain. A little later on he says this, it's worthwhile just reading it. He says, "Indeed, any definition of a word denoting an external thing you know, for any proper noun, for example, must ultimately rely on pointing at such a thing. Do you know what he means by that? Well, remember what we did with the number, okay? Remember I've destroyed the number 3 and the number 5, okay? Here in this class, you've seen two numbers destroyed forever. And what I asked there was, you know, what are those? And the answer came back, 3 and 5. And so when I did this, I obviously must have destroyed 3 and 5. Because they're gone now. But you see, they're not numbers, are they? What are they? They're symbols for the number. The number itself is invisible. Okay? The number itself is not a physical thing. It's the same with words. I mean, words aren't the thing, are they? Yes? You can see a thing and not know what it is, and you can make up a name or a word for it. So the word's not the thing. It's the little identification or description of the thing. But in order for you to make up a word for something, you're going to have to differentiate it from other things, do you see? Which also need names. And in order to do that, you're going to be able to point. Okay? Distinguish things. That's a very simple thing to do, isn't it? And it's rude, you know, don't point. But this is an extraordinary thing. Okay, that we can point to things and identify these things. This is what I mean. This is what I'm talking about. And our pointing is our physical bodies being directed by our minds. Do you see? Our thoughts. I hope this is not too... I know you're all smart, so don't get me wrong here, but at the same time, I hope this is not a little bit too abstract. But you understand that the firing of neurons in your brain has got nothing to do with this. I mean, the firing of neurons in your brain, why would it cause you to do this? Point and distinguish things. Why would it cause, you know, that? I mean, you don't literally point, okay? But when a couple meet each other, okay, they know each other. They kind of point to each other, okay? At least in their minds, in their recognition of each other. Do you see? This is my husband. This is my wife. This is my child. This is my house. Whatever. Do you see that? You're pointing to these things and you're distinguishing between these things. How can the neurons do that? Something else going on. Do you see? And that's what Polanyi is saying. That all use of words to describe things and to identify things involves this pointing of the person. And there's of late been a lot of work been done on this idea of the second person. Okay? In fact, you know that you can't actually think unless you can point. Okay? Because you're not just wrapped up in yourself. Okay? Unless you can point to identify things and differentiate things, you can't actually live in this world. You can't think. Because in order to think, you have to differentiate. I mean, don't you have to have the law of non-contradiction? This is my house. This is not my house. This is my car. This is not my car. The law of identity, you know, that will say, this is my dinner. I mean, you have to do those things, and if you can't do those things, you can't think. How can you do science unless you can differentiate between things? How can you go to work every day unless you differentiate between things? How can you decide to do anything? You can't. I know it sounds simple, but we take all of this stuff for granted. Where does it come from? Where does this ability come from? Because it's knowledge, isn't it? And Polanyi is saying that in the same way that we have this knowledge, this subsidiary knowledge that we use all the time, and that if we didn't have it, we couldn't actually do the thing that we were focusing on. Also, you have this idea that you can't focus on anything unless you can point to it. So you have this knowledge that you can't express that focuses on something that you can point at, which you can then learn from. Do you see, folks, how personal knowledge is? It's not impersonal, is it? So his magnum opus is a book called Personal Knowledge. And it was released in 1958 and has had some influence, particularly on someone I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, but not really has been ignored by the scientific and philosophical establishment. If Polanyi's idea of knowledge, which I believe is biblical, by the way, if his view of knowledge had been accepted, the world would be a very different place. Our understanding of who we are, our understanding of the world, and our understanding of what knowledge is and what science is would be very different. But he's actually describing the way things are. But we have been taught and we've bought into a idea of knowledge that is actually not the way things are. I'll press it a little bit more here. So if all knowledge involves this tacit, this subsidiary knowledge, in order to focus on something and learn something, of course, the thing that we're focusing on, say riding a bike, balancing, eventually may come into be a, what? Subsidiary knowledge. Do you see? Because we've learned that skill. It has this from to dimension, but it is all from you to you. It's all personal. Also, there's something else that's very important. In order to ride a bike, or in order to probe, for a blind person to probe, okay, you've got to be committed, haven't you? So when I told you to go forward, you know, and you, we put the chairs out there, you probably felt a little bit more intimidated with the chairs in the way than you did when the chairs weren't in the way. And you had to focus a little bit more. Okay? Even though you cheated before you did it. Still, yes, you had to focus a little bit harder. Yes? Is that right? You had to be more committed to the subject. When Charlie's showing a new fireman how to use a really important piece of equipment, okay, he expects that student, that learner, to really focus on what he's being taught. Do you see? I mean, not be on his cell phone and texting somebody like this, you know? He's got to focus. He's got to be committed to knowing that. Again, that commitment is essential to knowing. If you don't commit yourself, if you're not somewhat passionate toward that thing, and you move toward that thing, do you see? You won't learn. If you're not willing to do that, you just stand with a stick in your hand. In order to find out, you have to be committed, and then you'll go forward. Do you see? Same as Polanyi also talks about hitting a nail with a hammer. So what are you focusing on? You're focusing on a nail, yes? But you've got this whacking great thing here that you need to be careful of. Yeah. You've got to make sure you don't smack yourself in the head with it, don't you? But you're focusing on the nail. But actually you've got this other knowledge that you need, that you're not thinking about, in order to do the task that you're focusing on. And you've got to, in order to swing the hammer, in order to swing the mallet, okay, use the chainsaw, whatever, you have got to be committed. And again, do you see the personal dimension to knowing? All right. Have you got this? Okay. So, seeing as though all knowledge is personal, the only... A real extent, the only beings that can know in that way are human beings. You know, dogs and birds can find out how to do certain things, okay? But they don't acquire knowledge in the same way, and certainly not in the same variety. They're not inquisitive about the outside world like we are. They don't gather data and information. They don't, you know, think about the ramifications of things, even though God has given them innate knowledge of how to do things. Science, as often presented, is what? You have this neutral observer. Okay? This neutral observer is, as I've said, and as they like to say, willing to follow the evidence. I'm going to give you an example of this in a minute. Wherever it leads. I don't know, it's about wherever. All right. And then, of course, you develop, you know, a hypothesis. And then you test the hypothesis and retest the hypothesis. And it's all of this detached, cool, you know, it's the lab coat really is a great metaphor for it, isn't it? Because it's white and it's clean and it's sterile and it's, it kind of makes you feel as though there's a detachment between the scientist and what he's experimenting on. No, the lab coat really does that for you. So if I'd stood up here in the lab coat, you know, I think you guys would have thought I was a little bit more worth listening to because I've got the lab coat on. I mean, it's just a coat. That's all it is. But it does something to your imaginations. Okay? It makes you think differently. You've got to be aware of that. He develops a hypothesis. All right, well, hold on a minute. How many possible hypotheses are there? Yeah? So a scientist goes into the laboratory and he's got a million hypotheses that he needs to try. Well, actually, no, that's too few. Maybe there's a billion hypotheses he needs to try. And so he goes in and he's just this cool observer. He's detached. He's dispassionate. He's not bringing, he's neutral. You know, he's not bringing anything to it. And he's just there to follow the facts wherever they go. And he's never going to learn anything, is he? Is that how hypotheses are brought about? Now, he comes into the lab and he's already decided because of his what? Innate skill. Okay? When he was learning to be a scientist, okay, there was this transference of subsidiary knowledge into the focal point that he was learning about. And as he learned to do an experiment or learned about this, that became subsidiary to deeper things that he was doing, yes? And he has learned these skills. And he comes with this skill set and this ability to what? Identify what will be a workable hypothesis, possibly, from a bunch that won't. He's not dispassionate. In order to do his experiments, what does he need to do? Come on, what's the word?
Trial and error.
Yes, but what's my word?
Narrow down, focus.
He needs to focus, but in order to do anything, what does he need to do? Think about me with a stick here.
Probe.
I need to commit. Do you see? I need to commit myself. It's got to be a personal giving of myself to that subject. Do you see? Oh, the object, sorry. So he doesn't come in as a neutral observer. Now, you throw in the basic naturalistic paradigm of modern science that you see Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know, on Nova, or I mean David Attenborough, or anyone like that. Yeah, Richard Dawkins, anybody who gets airtime. Okay, Bill Nye, the science guy. All of these guys, they come with this naturalistic paradigm, don't they? This commitment. And are they neutral? Not only are they not neutral because of the skill set that they've learned, which enables them to narrow the possibilities down, okay? But they're not neutral because they are certainly not willing to follow the evidence wherever it leads. Why not? Because, sorry about the drawing. Naturalism only. The evidence can only be followed within the scope of naturalism. Do you see that? Now, is this a scientific conclusion? Did they go into the laboratory and empirically prove this? No. By the way, did they go into the laboratory and empirically prove the subsidiary knowledge they needed in order to find the laboratory? Do they go in there and do they prove normativity in order to conduct an experiment? Because you've got to have normativity, don't you? I mean, you've got to believe that the world has a kind of a normative uniformity to it, don't you? In order to do an experiment. Did they go in and prove that? What about if their experiment takes a long time, like, you know, Lenski's experiments, which have been done over, with E. coli, I think, over 30 years now, he's been doing these experiments on E. coli. And does he, when he gets up the next morning, does he test whether there is a connection between the morning he's just gotten up and the one that's passed? Does he test to see if tomorrow is going to happen? He assumes it, doesn't he? Do you see? He assumes the normativity of the world. He doesn't test it. But here's the thing. Can naturalism supply him with the knowledge that he needs, the tacit knowledge that he needs, in order to go into the laboratory? Think about that for a minute. For those people that just believe that consciousness is the firing of neurons in your brain, and it could be any other way, your beliefs that you are who you are and you live where you live are just, they're not really beliefs at all. It's just a trick played on you by your DNA. Okay? You're a mere machine. You don't have thoughts. You think the way you think because the laws of physics are making you think that way. Same as, you know, if I think I'm Napoleon, that's because my neurons are firing that particular way. There's no difference between me thinking I'm Napoleon and you thinking that you're who you are. Not if that's the right view of the world. But how do you equate that belief, because that is a widely held belief, by the way, not just by people like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett and Jerry Coyne and people like that. Many, many people believe this. What do you make of that saying from a foundation like that, of pure naturalism? You're not going to follow the evidence wherever it leads because you're not interested in evidence. You're not interested in following. You're actually not interested in anything. You're interested in what your brain chemistry says you're interested, makes you interested in. But this implies that there is evidence out there, that there's truth out there, and we haven't dealt with truth yet, but we will, that there's truth out there to be ascertained, which is independent of your brain chemistry, doesn't it? Does naturalism support that view? No, it doesn't. So where are they getting this from? If naturalism, which they say is the only net that can be used, doesn't support what they're trying to do, or say they're trying to do, where are they getting this from? This one here particularly. They can't be getting it from their worldview, folks. They must have stolen it from another worldview that actually can account for this. So again, what are we doing? We are questioning the net. So here's Douglas Futuyama, his book Evolution. This is a popular textbook in colleges. I'm going to read a little bit from it, okay? Hopefully from what I've said already, you might be able to see some problems with what he says. Science is not a collection of facts, contrary to popular belief, but rather a process of acquiring understanding of natural phenomena. This process consists largely of posing hypotheses and testing them with observational and experimental evidence. Despite loose talk about proving hypotheses, most scientists agree with philosophers of science that scientists cannot absolutely prove hypotheses. That is, they cannot attain absolute guaranteed proof of the kind that can be obtained in mathematics. Remember what we've said about what do you need in order to do mathematics? Numbers. Okay, but where do you get numbers from in this? This is materialism. This is the natural world's all you've got. Okay? You don't believe in immaterial realities. Rather, the hypothesis that currently best explains the data is provisionally accepted with the understanding that it may be altered, expanded, or rejected if subsequent evidence warrants doing so, or if a better hypothesis not yet imagined is devised. Sometimes, indeed, a radically new paradigm, remember that word, replaces an old one. For example, plate tectonics revolutionized geology in the 1950s, replacing the conviction that the continents were fixed in position. He continues and goes down, and he says, this process reflects one of the most important and valuable features of science. Even if individual scientists may be committed to a hypothesis, scientists as a group are not irrevocably committed to any belief and do not maintain it in the face of convincing contrary evidence or contrary evidence. They must and do change their minds if the evidence so warrants. You know, they're these people. Indeed, much of science consists of seeking chinks in the armor of established ideas, and few successes will burnish a scientist's reputation more than showing that an important orthodox hypothesis is an inadequate or flawed. Thus, science as a social process is tentative. It questions belief and authority. It continuously tests its views against evidence. Do you believe this rubbish?
No. You think about Darwin.
Scientific claims, in fact, are the outcome of a process of natural selection. For ideas and scientists compete with one another so that the body of ideas in a scientific field grows in explanatory content and power. And he quotes an authority there, an evolutionist. So natural selection here is not just a physical thing, it's also an ideational thing, according to him. Okay? I mean, it involves science. Science differs in this way from creationism, which does not use evidence to test its claims, does not allow evidence to shake its a priori commitment to certain beliefs, and does not grow in its capacity to explain the natural world. And it continues. That's absolute bunkum. But it's in a college textbook. This is one of the most widely used college textbooks. By the way, I know you didn't pick it up, and there's no reason why you would have picked it up, but he begins and ends that paragraph by talking about the explanation of the natural world. And when he talks about the natural world, it's okay to talk about the natural world, don't get me wrong. What he means is the natural world as cordoned off by the philosophy of naturalism. The belief in naturalism. The commitment, the prior commitment to naturalism. The absolute foundation of naturalism. But hold on. Because I thought he said here that scientists as a group are not irrevocably committed to any belief and do not maintain it in the face of convincing contrary evidence. Well, there's plenty of contrary evidence against naturalism. In fact, one of their own major philosophers of science, Thomas Nagel, I'll put his name up here if you want. Thomas Nagel has written a book called Mind and Cosmos. I may bring it in and quote it a little bit for you later on, in which he says that the neo-Darwinian paradigm is almost certainly wrong. And he has been, I mean, he has been just blasted by the scientific community. You know, the community that must and do change their mind when the evidence warrants it. We haven't got to evolution, but Connie here pointed out, hold on a minute, these people don't question evolution. In fact, if there is one thing that you are not ever, ever to question, it's the theory of evolution, or the fact, as they say it, of evolution, isn't it? Do these people as a group commit themselves to irrevocably to evolution? Absolutely they do. And naturalism? Absolutely they do. In fact, it's got so bad that in the last, we'll just say 100 years, but the definition of the methodology that you use, the approach that you're supposed to have in your head when it comes to doing any of the natural sciences is called methodological naturalism. In other words, you are only to seek natural explanations for natural phenomena. What's that? Sounds like that to me, doesn't it? If you're only to seek, if science is only to seek natural explanations for natural phenomena, they're already dictating the rules of the game. And they will only follow the evidence as long as it leads to where they want it to lead, back to naturalism. It's circular, do you see? Is the scientist in his lab coat unbiased? Does he come with a hypothesis in his mind that he's going to test and follow the evidence where, well, what if the scientist has a hypothesis, and his scientific hypothesis that he wants to test is that natural phenomena cannot explain the natural world? For example, the theory of evolution is an unsatisfactory explanation for the diversity of life. That's intelligent design, at least, which we will go into in, probably next week. Wouldn't that be science? But wouldn't it be science? You'd be testing a hypothesis, wouldn't you? Ah, but the problem is, you see, what this bloke hasn't told us is that there's this prior belief that is unshifting that they are absolutely religiously committed to. It's got nothing to do with science. This is a philosophy. Is it a good philosophy? No, it's a really stupid one. It's a really dumb one. Again, as we will see in the weeks to come. But they're committed to it. All right. So Stephen Meyer, you may have heard of him. He's an intelligent design advocate. I really recommend his books. This is called Signature in the Cell. He's written another one that's a sequel to this called Darwin's Doubt. They're both outstanding. I think that all of you here could read these books and understand what he's talking about. He's a very good communicator. And chapter 18 of his book, he says this, and I'm not going to go into all of it, but he says, in December 2005, Judge John E. Jones III ruled that a Dover, Pennsylvania school district could not tell its biology students about a book in the school library that explained the theory of intelligent design. The judge based his decision on the testimony of expert witnesses, two philosophers, Robert Pennock and Barbara Forrest, who argued that the theory of intelligent design is not scientific by definition. By definition. Since it is not scientific, the judge reasoned, it must be religious. As he put it in his ruling, quote, since ID is not science, the conclusion is inescapable that the only real effect of the ID policy is the advancement of religion, end quote. Do we sound, do you think Barbara Forrest and Robert Pennock are dispassionate scientific philosophers? Far from it. Very far from it, actually. You've heard about the Scopes trial, I presume, back in the 1920s. The Scopes monkey trial. Darrow lost the case. Okay, Brian won the case in the Scopes trial. But what was it about? It was about whether evolution could be taught in the classroom. What are evolutionists doing now? They're saying that creationism or intelligent design cannot be taught in the classroom because it's not science. You see, what they've done in the intervening period is that not only have they got, rightly, by the way, rightly, evolution taught in the classroom as a scientific theory, which is fine, no problem with that. Okay, I think it's stupid, but I think it should be taught because it is, from a naturalist point of view, it's the only game in town, unless you believe the world's not there. But they've now redefined science within the bounds of evolutionary naturalism. And now creationists, who actually do scientific work, and ID proponents, who do scientific work and research, and some of them, you know, quite advanced work, are not even to be allowed to have a voice. They're not to, I mean, their research is not allowed in the peer-reviewed journals because it's not science because of this definition of prior commitment to naturalism. And so the tables have been completely turned, but turned in such a way that now by definition, anything that's not evolution isn't science. And again, I'm asking you, and we're going to go on and do more about this, but I'm asking you, is that a scientific point of view, or is that more of a religious point of view? It's actually, it's a belief. It's their religion. Okay? They don't test it in the laboratory. It's not brought about by the inevitable laws of logic, which they can't explain, by the way, naturalistically anyway. It's just a prior commitment. So folks, do not believe Nova or, you know, the science channels, I don't even know, the science books. Don't believe these guys when they tell you that science is just out to look for the facts. They're not. They're not. In fact, there is good evidence, and it's accruing evidence, and I'll bring some of it to you, that they are actually holding up scientific inquiry because they're not allowing anything but naturalistic explanations for things. Now, in order to have naturalistic explanations, are you okay with this
so far? Okay. In order to have purely naturalistic explanations. Yes. Yes.
You know, in the last year, and especially the last 6 months, you know, there's been quite this emphasis from the political situation that's arisen in our country, where now there's this humongous effort to promote science. You know, science is facts. Science is people. Mm-hmm. Science is, you know, our salvation, really.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, they're having marches to promote science, and, you know, it's amazing to, mm-hmm. to see how that's all developed. Like, that's panacea for our problems.
So when you hear of marches for science, which there was recently,
yeah.
Okay, what... Your antenna should go up, and what should you think? I mean, as a young person, Hannah, I don't know if you've been staying all the way with this, but when you read about a march for science, okay, automatically, what should you think? I don't put you on the spot, but just in case you wanted to say something. Might you say something like, well, it's not really science, because they're not interested in following the evidence, and most of this stuff actually is not, they've not tested, it's just their belief system that they're calling science, and they're only allowing their belief to be called science.
And I would say almost exclusively it's science that supports a liberal point.
Exactly.
And, you know, you don't see the science marches in support of Trump. It's really a political statement couched in science.
Why?
Veracity.
Well, we'll get into that, but evolutionism, you see, supports the radical agendas of liberals, so-called progressives.
It's intriguing that they even use that word, because it's not progressive.
Yeah, well, G.K. Chesterton says you know, if everything really is inextricably moving towards progress anyway, then to be a progressive is actually to be nothing, because everything's going to go its way whether you're a progressive or not. Do you see? You can't help progress along, because progress has its own pace. Yeah, we'll get a little bit into that. That's why I'm going to take a few weeks to cover this material. Anyway, I do strongly recommend, and we'll go back to some of this, I strongly recommend that you buy Meyer's work. Okay. So you've got this sham of what is called science. It's not science, folks. Most of it is bad philosophy, just misnamed.
Mm-hmm.
Evolution is not science. Naturalism is not science. There is absolutely no reason in this world to even do science if naturalism is true. And there is no reason to restrict science purely to the investigation of natural causes. It certainly is the investigation of the natural world. Don't get me wrong. Science is the investigation of the natural world. But it is not the investigation of the natural world for or through purely natural causes. That's the problem there. Think back to Polanyi then. Think back to this idea of probing, this idea of hitting the nail with a hammer. In fact, think about another illustration that he gave. Can you all read this sentence for me? Okay. Two things are happening when you're reading that sentence, okay, which involves, again, this idea of subsidiary or tacit knowledge. You already have the skills to know what these symbols mean, and you weren't even thinking about them when you were reading them. You were going directly, you were focusing on the meaning of the sentence. You see? That these symbols guide you to. Again, you cannot even read a sentence without this from to idea of knowledge, this personal commitment to knowledge. Knowledge, all knowledge is personal knowledge. So let's look at knowledge as, or science as personal knowledge, a personal discovery. First thing, only persons know. Trees don't know. This cup of water I'm going to drink here, it doesn't know I'm going to take a drink. Or that I've taken a drink. My pen doesn't know that I'm going to use it. Mickey Mouse doesn't know he's a cartoon character. Only persons know. To know something, one must commit to it. The person must commit to it. This means that there is a connection between the knower and the known, or what is to be known. You cannot dispassionately look at it. You cannot dispassionately focus on it. You have to, in a sense, passionately, committedly focus on it, which means that in focusing on it, it has some kind of a grip, some kind of a power on you. Do you see? You participate, in a sense, with it. You go out to it, and it yields its data to you. So the knowledge is participatory. You go out to the creation, and creation kind of, you enter into it and you find out about it. I have not got, in England you call it green fingers, okay? You call it green thumbs. But I don't have either. I don't have green fingers or thumbs. My mum does, and there are people that, you know, can grow amazing flowers, amazing roses, and they understand about scent, and they understand about what makes up a rose, and how to grow a perfect rose, and so on. And they get captivated by that rose, okay, or whatever it might be. That might be a marrow or watermelon or something like that. They get captivated by it. They have to, if they're going to be expert in it, if they're going to know about it, they have to get that kind of captivation. Yes? They have to get swept away by it in order to find out more and more. If they just are dispassionate, if they just are looking at it merely as an object, and they are not subjectively entering into the knowing subject, they're going to know less about it. So I don't know hardly anything about, I'll call it American football, okay? I know you call it football, but even though you don't hardly kick it with a foot, but I don't hardly know anything about it, so I can't get very passionate about it. Real football, on the other hand, where you kick the ball with the foot, okay, I can get pretty passionate about that, okay, both in when I used to play it and as a fan, okay? And you understand that you get more out of it the more you enter into it. You know more the more you, as a subject, enter into the object of it. Yes? So that you have that kind of participation. This means that all objective science, if you're really going to know something, also is subjective. There's no such thing as merely being concerned with objectivity. Mere objectivity will not get you to know something as you need to know it, or as much as you could know it. You're going to have to be subjectively involved in it too. So you can know a lot about the Bible. You can know a lot about God. But unless you move toward God, unless you move and are absorbed by and enthralled by what you're told about God, what you're finding out about God, you will not enter into and participate in that knowledge of God or His world. You'll just be merely objective. So if you're merely standoffish and objective about something, you're not knowing it as much as you could know it. How do you explain that from a naturalistic point of view? How do you explain it from the point of view of creation? Genesis 1. And I'm not answering the question for you, come on. Why did God make Eden? Why didn't He just give him a gravel road to live on? What's that? No, but no. Well, there's something to what you're saying, but not quite. Why did God make Eden? What do you think of when you think of Eden?
He wanted to make something that the man would be passionately interested in.
Yes. Yes, he would aesthetically be involved in it. He would participate in it. He'd get knowledge from and get enjoyment from and be able to glorify God the Creator as he entered into it. Do you see? Could he be a decent scientist and enter into passionately what God had done? Of course he could. Of course he could. But if you have this idea of, you know, just give me a lab coat and I'll be, you know, this objective observer, you're not going to find out about the world the way you need to find out about it. The more askance you are and aloof that you are, the less that you will truly know. You might know a lot of data, but you don't know it as you should know it. There's a big difference between... Well, I'm trying to use something, you know. Watching a basketball game and playing in a basketball game. Or watching a symphony and playing in a symphony. Do you see that? Watching a play and being part of that play. So all objective science, to really be science in the way that it ought to be, is also subjective. Now here's the next thing. All knowledge is personal knowledge. But there is a hierarchy of participation. You know, as fascinating and amazing as water is, and it is, it's inanimate. Okay? So my subjectivity, my delving into water, is not going to be the same as me getting to know my dog. Why not? Yes. And my involvement with my dog, unless I'm a bit loopy, is not going to be the same as my involvement with my friend or with my wife or kids. Do you see? And this is the way it should be. The more personal you get, the higher up you get, the more of subjective involvement there should be in order to know, so that to know God involves the whole person. Do you see? In the act of knowing. That's glory. When your whole person, minus all of the, you know, dirt bag that you are, when all of that is gone and you are remade and your mind does not think a sinful thought and you're in tune because your sin is not clouding and distorting your thinking, and you're in tune with the supernatural realm as well as the natural realm, and the two become one, and the reality of the Creator dawns on you, now you see through a glass darkly. Then face to face, there's a huge difference between those two things. When you see face to face, you will be absorbed in it. Do you see? So the level of knowing actually goes up, in a sense, with the level of personality that is involved in the object. Okay? I mean, you get some poets that write poems like Ode to a Grecian Urn and things like that. But it's not like love poetry to someone that was lost. The love that we once knew, write fadeless on the air. We don't write something like that about a fishing rod or, your favorite chair or something like that, do you? So the level of subjectivity rises with it, but don't think that the objectivity diminishes. It doesn't. The objectivity also increases because you are knowing it. You're just knowing it better as you're participating in it. Okay. This way of knowing that we've been talking about here is not peculiar to just one walk of life. Every single walk of life, every single aspect of knowing involves this, which means science too. This is how scientists know too. If this is the way of knowing that science uses, and it uses it the same way that other areas use knowing, do you see? Then this separation between science, hard science, the facts, stuff that Fukuyama was talking about, and other things like humanities and so on, it's not there. It might be there somewhat differing in the means that you use in order to know something. You don't know the beauty of a flower by picking it apart analytically. You know it by seeing it and experiencing it that way, don't you? You don't know the beauty of a Shakespeare sonnet by deconstructing it, okay? But by entering into it. So you wouldn't use a scientific empirical analysis to know Shakespeare as you would if you were finding out about, what a flower was made up of. But you see, there's no difference in the importance of knowing the beauty of a flower and know what a flower is as a flower and analyzing it, taking it apart. These are just different ways of knowing the flower, do you see? One of them is science and uses different approaches than just painting it or admiring it or smelling it. But both of them are arriving at knowledge in the same way, just using different approaches. That's so important because in the biblical worldview, knowledge is one. in order to find out things, we have to use different ways of getting to know things. Okay? You don't get to know or predict a solar eclipse in the same way you go to the cupboard to find crackers. Okay? To find crackers, you don't have to do a mathematical equation. You go up and you open the cupboard and see if there's any crackers there, you see? But they're both equal ways of knowing things. And both, by the way, involve this personal element of commitment. Whoops. All right. Just a few more things and then we'll go. So I talked about a little bit about Polanyi. Now I'm going to talk a little bit, just for a few minutes. What's the time? Can't see it there.
Quarter after.
Oh, okay, good. About Thomas Kuhn, who was influenced by Polanyi's work. Thomas Kuhn, okay, it's K-U-H-N. And his book, The Structure of Scientific, you impressed already, Revolutions. Now, in order to kind of cut down some time, I'm going to read from me from a while ago back. In 1962, the philosopher Thomas Kuhn created a stir in the academic world with his book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. In this book, Kuhn asserted that the hard scientists, which formerly were believed to be pursuing and delivering up absolute truths, were, in fact, vulnerable to overriding presuppositions and the incursions of uncertainty. Am I okay with this? Kuhn has taught us that no one is completely objective, certainly not scientists. He shows that the scientist is influenced in his experiments by the scientific culture of the community of which he is a part. Like Fukuyama is, okay? Scientific theories are therefore not evaluated discreetly, but as part of networks of assumptions which sometimes change together rather radically. He works within the accepted rules of that community, countenancing, quote, the assured results of scholarship. Footnote, within the paradigm of what's accepted in that community at that particular time. He prioritizes his research in line with what the community thinks is important, and very importantly, folks, what those with the money think is important. Okay? And I think I've said before that if you come out as a scientist and say there's no such thing as global warming, okay, you're not going to get any grants, because that's boring. If you say that there's a global warming crisis and so on, and this huge iceberg has just broken off in the Antarctic, you know about that, and that's surely a sign of global warming and how terrible this is, then you're going to get gobs of money. Okay, if it don't make sense, there's a buck in it. By the way, you know why these big things break off? The ice caps?
It's so heavy.
Yes. It's just the basic laws of physics, yeah. I mean, they get so big. The ice caps get so big that these things break off. Okay, it's not melting, folks. Anyway. So he's got to be looking for the things the establishment expects him to look for. Vern Poitras says, all data is theory-laden. In other words, although we haven't looked at evidences yet, no evidence shouts up to us and say, oh, I'm this. Okay, this is the way you interpret me. We come to facts with certain assumptions. Okay? We come with certain worldviews. If you come with a naturalistic evolutionist worldview, if you come with an Eastern worldview, if you come with a biblical worldview, do you see that your interpretations may differ? But we'll come to that. It already presupposes in its very status as data for a given experiment or a given theory that the universe is organized in a way compatible with the assumptions of science as a whole. The current disciplinary matrix affects how scientists make observations. That is the current culture. What they think the observations actually measure, that's what they're looking for, and what kinds of data or experiments are relevant to the outstanding open questions in their field. What they will test and what they won't test. Or what they'll test for and what they won't test for. Normal science continues within what Kuhn calls the reigning paradigm or scientific worldview of the scientific community. As anomalies appear, they are either kept at arm's length or left for the machine of scientific progress to process further in time. But if these anomalies increase, the explanatory power of the reigning paradigm begins to appear less attractive because you've got more and more problems, you see, that are being found out. Think of Newton's gravitational theory and so on, replaced by Einstein's theory of relativity, yes? New problems create new questions, the answers to which seem to be beyond the present way of doing science. A scientific revolution occurs when someone, for example, Copernicus, Newton, Pasteur, Planck, Einstein, puts forward a new and more explanatory theory, which quickly becomes the reigning paradigm. The textbooks are revised to reflect the new approach, but, quote, the desperate twistings, retrogressions, denials, and struggles are omitted, so as to lend a false impression that science is one continuous linear search for truth, that it goes where the facts lead. That's exactly what we read in Fujiyama. Okay, it's a process. Remember? Now, we did talk about the one theory displacing another theory, okay, plate tectonics, but still, what he didn't say is that the scientific establishment once held this, and they held it dogmatically, and then, finally, it was seen to have problems, and it was replaced by a better model, which was accepted and embraced, and then the textbooks were revised, and the struggles and the denials, and the top scientists say, no, this is heresy, okay, that's all written out. And science is, again, just this search for truth, you know, this upward and onward idea, this process. Now, what Kuhn, because he's not a Christian, he's not a theist, he's not coming within a Christian worldview, what he comes up with is that science and the ideas of science is basically, at the end of the day, relativistic. Because one paradigm is going to replace another paradigm, is going to replace another paradigm. When I was young, the world was, I think, I'm not that old. Nobody's ever believed in the flat earth, by the way. No Christian. But, when I was younger, it was, the universe was, I think, was it 24 billion years old? And now it's less than that. It's about 12 billion years old, or 14 billion years old. What's that?
Depends on who you talk to.
Yeah. 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 But there were different, you know, different views. Certainly when I was young, you know, well, in fact, only, what, 10 years ago, DNA was it. All of the information of life was in DNA. Do you know that all the information of life is not in DNA? Did you know that? Richard Dawkins liked to talk about the fact that we dance to the tune of our DNA. Again, it's more of that deterministic claptrap. But no, DNA actually doesn't just have that. There's actually the proteins as well, and the protein folds, and the particular way that proteins are folded conveys information. The actual structure, not what's in it, but the structure conveys information too. There's all kinds of different things, and they're discovering more and more all the time. So science changes, yes. They until very recently, in fact, I think during this recent trial at Dover, these naturalistic evolutionists were saying that most of the DNA was junk DNA. And that fits their evolutionary model, yes? Survival of the fittest and just weed out the, you know, the trial and error stuff. And it was the ID proponents who were saying, no, if we're right and it's an intelligent design, then you design things, okay, from the top down, okay? Not kind of search and figure out how to do it, but from the top down. You see what you want, you try and figure out, and so on, go the way down to get the minutiae. So there won't be this terrible waste of time and futility of trying to get somewhere to some kind of goal, you see? And lo and behold, now everybody has accepted through the ENCODE process and so on, that there is no or very little junk DNA. That what was thought to be junk DNA is actually extremely important to, you know, the mechanism of life. Oh, by the way, that kind of discovery where the ID proponents were saying this, if we're right, this, there will be no junk DNA, and evolutionists were saying, if we're right, there will be junk DNA, shouldn't that have caused Fukuyama to change his mind? Has he changed his mind? No, because he's not following the facts anywhere they point. Nearly finished here, folks. Another fascinating aspect of the change from one paradigm to another is that before the paradigm shift is completed, the two groups of scientists, those traditionalists who want to hold on to the old but increasingly awkward-looking theory, and those questioners looking to abandon it for the new explanation, will for a time be unable to comprehend each other clearly. Because they're stuck in their, you know, ways of thinking. This is because within each group's worldview there is a continuity in which all reality emerges out of what is already there. Which is just another way of saying that they think they have an explanation of how things must go within the paradigm that they've accepted. And so that's all they're looking for. What my net can't catch ain't fish. Now, final thing that I'll say here then, I hope that you can see that pushing out the Christian worldview and creationism, I mean in the right sense, and intelligent design, and certainly not all intelligent design proponents are Christians, or even believers, even theists, and I'll be quoting one, an agnostic, probably next week. pushing that out and say it's not science is not a scientific procedure. It's just people who have defined science in such a way, they've just, you know, made the net, they've made the rules of the game to fit their paradigm. Now, as more and more, as Gary said there, as the complexity of the universe, as the complexity of the cell, the astonishing beauty of and simplicity, in the right sense of the word, is discovered, it's really, really getting hard to say that natural selection did this, that blind chance did this. These things really do look designed. Okay? And I want you to, for your homework, I want you to go online and I want you to look up a little video on the kinesin. Okay? Kinesin. And you tell me whether blind chance was responsible for that.